From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, what's the best way to get your church to change something? We're talking about the LDS Church in this case, and a question the reporter Lee Hale is asking in a story he's producing. Basically, it's this question: who gets credit for change when it comes? Because change always comes. But is it the faithful driving it quietly from inside, or the activists making a ruckus in public? Join us after this.
I'm Andrew Becker, the news director here at KUER. Our newsroom is growing, with new reporters set to join us in the coming months. In the meantime, we want to know, what issues should we be covering where you live? What stories should we be telling in your community? Help us improve our coverage of Utah by answering a few short questions. Go to KUER.org and click Community Feedback Form under the About tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about change in The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. KUER's Lee Hale has produced a story that explores how change works or doesn't work in Mormonism. The church is always changing, but what is it that makes leaders change? Does it come from the top, from the members, from the activists? And just who gets the credit? As Lee found in his story, right now the credit goes to the leaders. Lee Hale reports on religion for KUER. He's working on a podcast for the station. We'll tell you more about that a little bit later on the program. His story on faith and activism is available online at KUER.org. Lee, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Doug.
So I wanted to start with, what were the things that were happening that made you start thinking about this idea of change and how it works?
Well, a lot's been said over a little over a year now that Russell Nelson has been the president of the LDS Church. There's been a lot of change happening. Some of it is kind of like minor change that only Mormons would be excited about, like two-hour church.
Yeah.
But some is kind of verging on pivotal deep change that hits at some core concerns Mormons have. A few months ago, there was some minor changes to the temple ceremony, mm-hmm. which was a weird thing to talk about because Mormons were explicitly told not to talk about it.
Yep.
Everyone was curious. Obviously, if you tell someone not to talk about it, what do they do?
And people were careful, but they were talking about it. And a lot of people were really excited about the change.
And just to make it really as simplistic as possible, the temple kind of became, the ceremony became less deferential to the men in the room and kind of empowered both the men and the women in their connection to God. So it was kind of an equality moment.
Something we should say women have been, if not outwardly talking about, have been talking about for a good time now.
Well, that's what got me interested. So,
okay.
So the change happens.
Yeah.
Russell Nelson uses the word revelation pretty freely.
Yeah.
Which, as a prophet, I think is a word to use. But I think a lot of Latter-day Saints were scratching their head thinking, I think people have brought these concerns for a long time, saying the temple ceremony wasn't very respectful to the role of women and that they were more deferential roles as wives and not as individuals, mm-hmm. as children of God. And so the question people had was, well, was God just waiting for the right time and then he told his prophet to make the change, or was this a buildup of years and years and years of people saying, this feels weird, telling their local leaders, telling their friends, maybe telling general authorities of the church? The church would never say that. The way the church operates, they don't give credit to the little conversations. They give credit to God and to themselves.
Okay, but that seems like what the story is about.
Right.
Like, who gets credit?
Right.
Like, that's not a minor point.
No.
Leaders are not giving credit except for God. They're not basically saying something precipitated this change necessarily.
Exactly.
At least doesn't seem like they're saying that outwardly.
Right. And the other thing that was making me think about this is about nearly a year ago now, last summer, Sam Young, who was making news for doing a fast outside of the Temple Square in Salt Lake, was advocating for Latter-day Saint leaders to stop asking sexually explicit questions in one-on-one interviews with children.
Former bishop, this man.
Former bishop,
yep.
Now former member.
Yep.
Because his activism eventually got him excommunicated, which happens. During his time of protest, it was literal protest, the church did revise some guidelines for leaders. They didn't quite meet his demands, but they made some minor changes and they clarified some things and said, you can bring a parent in with you if you don't feel comfortable. It seemed like a direct response to what he was doing. And yet, again, church leaders would not say that he had anything to do with it or that they were at all influenced by his activism. And so I...
Why? Why? Like, that seems like a big question.
Well, that's kind of the question.
Yeah, it is.
And that is the question that got me thinking about this, is what is the danger in acknowledging that you are being influenced by members of the church? If you are a church for the members, why wouldn't the members have a say? Well, the way the church feels right now, at least, the vibe is that it is a revelation church and that members aren't a part of the change. But as a journalist, I have to think they are.
I'm also interested in a related question, and that is, what works best to get the LDS church to actually change? Because regardless of whether they say they change, as you mentioned, there are minor changes and even big changes, structural changes that happen kind of all the time. And so what works best? Working quietly from the inside or being an activist, being really bold and outspoken and working from the outside? Like, which thing works best to get the church to actually change?
Well, is your goal to be a member at the end of the change? Because that's the big question.
Yeah.
I mean, you see people, activists who, for instance, and to throw out another name, Kate Kelly with Ordained Women. Some people could say Ordained Women was a failure, but Kate Kelly put Mormon feminism on the map in a lot of ways that was not before. She was part of a movement. And a lot of people who support Kate Kelly are still part of the church. And so you could say in some ways, well, activism doesn't work. See what happened. Kate Kelly was excommunicated. Women don't have the priesthood. I see activism as being effective, but the activist is running a high risk.
Yeah.
The other option, which is the slow kind of buildup of potentially people asking their local leaders and talking to each other and kind of building and building, that's effective if you want to stay in the good graces of the church. So I would say both can bring about change. It just depends on where you want to be.
Where you want to end up. Sam Young, same example.
Same thing.
And both cases, whether the church actually acknowledges this or not, both Sam Young and Kate Kelly, I think it could be argued, made change happen within the LDS church.
I think so. I think it's pretty obvious. You could say that they didn't because their exact demands, because both of them had very clear demands, were not met. Women did not receive the priesthood, and bishops still talk about sexual activity with children. That's still a thing that happens. But
things have shifted.
Things have shifted. And at the very least, these conversations have become much more public and less taboo for the people coming after them who, you know, don't have to be as extreme in their, you know, as them, but they can now have more leniency in talking about these things.
Okay. I want to work through a test case that you go through in your piece to talk about how these changes work or how they don't work. It's the case of Mormon women who wanted to change the practice that only men pray in LDS General Conference. So set that up for us. So for years and years and years, it was only men who prayed.
Which is honestly just weird because women were speaking General Conference.
Yeah.
And so it felt like a big oversight. But simply put, up until 2013, a woman had not prayed in General Conference. That's the twice yearly, like, worldwide meeting of church members.
All right, we need to bring another voice into the conversation. Amber Chorby Whiteley is joining us, was an organizer of Let Women Pray, which petitioned church leaders to let women pray in LDS General Conference. She's joining us here. And I should also mention she's a PhD candidate in counseling psychology with us here in the studio. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what got you started thinking about this? Just take me through how it worked, how you thought about what you wanted and how you figured you'd go about it.
So this was before Ordained Women, and what we were doing was seen as really radical. And I think that would be kind of shocking to think of now.
What, you mean really radical to get women to pray?
To ask for any request that was from the outside rather than being from the inside of the church. So we...
Wait. Did you think about asking inside the church first? Did you figure, no, let's go outside and try to get this thing to work?
Well, we had several people kind of within the Mormon feminist group who had tried, who would send these letters off to the like main church offices asking some of the highest leaders, you know, why can't a woman pray in general conference? And what would happen is that their letters would be forwarded off to their stake president or to their bishop. And then it could become this whole conversation about whether someone was temple worthy if they were advocating for things that they shouldn't be advocating for.
And so wait. So they were being scolded for bringing it up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at times. Or, you know, especially if there was a letter that was being sent to church offices that would cite more than just asking about letting women and pray in general conference, but around general feminist topics. I think that there's that famous quote, I forget from who, that says that, you know, biggest threat to the church is like feminist scholars and homosexuals. And being a feminist is kind of a sin, or at least has been, I think, especially more pre-ordained women times. It was to out yourself as a feminist, which I hate to kind of use that term. But I think I remember having my own process of coming out and feeling like that was risky as a feminist.
And Amber, I was just going to say that the timing was intentional too.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
in December 2012 is when there was women wore pants to church, right?
Right. Yeah. So in December 2012 was women wearing pants to church. And so that kind of started the conversation of previously, before all that, that Mormon feminists had really been in hiding, and it was pretty rare to organize kind of publicly. So to have like this public event, as silly as it is, to wear pants to church, it caused a big uproar. Like, there were quite a few people who were kind of outraged that this was a thing that was happening, and it got conversation going. And for Mormon feminists, I myself at the time felt like, well, this is an exciting time. How do we keep this ball rolling? Yeah. What's something? And I was really moving from like a strategic place of like, what's something that feels like it could be that church leaders would listen to and hear, and that Mormon feminists could feel heard. And that for me, myself, I was kind of like, I see myself and I see other women in the church who are really in a place of hurting. And what's a small policy change that could really make me feel like church leaders take my concerns seriously as a feminist?
So there's some symbolism involved in this act of a woman actually praying.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the criticisms that we got was like, why do you care about this? It's so small. Mm-hmm. And for me, there was so much more tied behind it. Just like almost an outright message that like there is a place for women in this church, and we are willing to adapt and think about ways in which maybe our biases are influencing church policy and things like that.
So do you think that because you figured we want this change, and nothing is going to happen if we work within the internal sort of mechanism of the church.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to go outside.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, I think – I'm trying to think of what my calling was at the time. I think it was – I might have been within primary. And so like thinking about like my own places of people that I can go and talk to and advocate, there wasn't much room for talking with the other primary president to figure out how we could make this change within the church. So I was like, what is something that I can do? And social media is this amazing platform to be able to reach Mormons all across. And we saw that with Wear Pants to Church. Mm-hmm. It was just a small Facebook event that grew and grew and grew and snowballed. And so,
but that means going public.
It does, yeah. And
did you know what that meant? Like, did you think, oh, man, this is risky?
Yeah, I didn't realize how risky it was.
Huh.
So I'm a convert to the church, and a thing that I really resonate and still resonate with is this idea that Joseph Smith asked questions, and that's what led to the church existing. And so I thought for myself, what brought me to the church was asking questions. And so that's kind of how I live my faith, is by asking questions. And I did not realize, I wasn't kind of raised with the church culture around being told not to ask questions. Mm. I was like, of course I can ask these questions. And I was a little naive of myself. And I did not realize the kind of controversy that it was going to cause at the time.
What did people at the ward say to you? I'm guessing you got some pushback and maybe some sideward glances, maybe.
Yeah. I think within my ward, most people tried to avoid talking with me about it. There were some that were really supportive. It was often done secretly, so I would get secret Facebook messages or secret emails from people in my ward, women in my ward.
Saying what?
that they were supportive of what it was that I was doing, and they were excited that I was reaching out. You know, I think what's like really important to note is that with Let Women Pray, we tried really hard to be as faithful as possible. We were all faithful members, and we were trying to go about it the most respectful way possible so that more members could identify with what we were trying to do and not see it as something that was disrespectful to even ask for. And so I think there were quite a few people who did resonate with that, but then there were quite a few people who culturally didn't feel like it was okay to even ask the question to advocate. And we were told that maybe this isn't the way that we were supposed to go about it.
But what was the way you're supposed to go about it?
That's my question too, right? Because
there's not a way. I mean, it's almost as if, I won't speak for you, but it's almost as if there's not a way. Like, it's raising a question of wanting some sort of change is like, that's not your job.
Mm-hmm.
God will make the change. We'll make the change here at church headquarters. You guys just do your thing.
Right.
Well, that's what I think what Amber's approach was the genius part of it was how old school it was. Because what you ended up asking for was letters.
Right.
I mean, you got the attention. I mean, I think there's some national press who's like, this is strange that women haven't prayed in general conference. What is that? And they were curious. So you got that buzz. But at the end of the day, all you were asking was to collect letters asking church leaders to do this. And so it's like there can't be a more like old school way than like, I'm going to write you a letter and ask for something.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that was kind of like that simplicity made it so effective.
Yeah, I agree. I think like simplicity and also like really tame in terms of activism, you know, to have a letter writing campaign asking to let a woman pray when, like, as you've kind of mentioned, that this seemed to be like a oversight that this hadn't happened or maybe bias seeping into it. And so part of what we were asking is like, why hasn't this happened and can we change that?
Did you get any response?
Not directly, but at the time, and this is still true, the church like PR department had released a public statement saying that basically a woman praying in general conference, there's like nothing barring a woman from praying in general conference. It just hasn't happened.
Wait, hold on. So because something happens then. I want to get to this thing that happens.
Mm-hmm.
They change.
I mean— Yeah, the reason this story is so fascinating to me is you guys began organizing in January and February.
But they change and they don't say anything about the fact that they changed.
Right.
They just changed.
And it was so quick. It was within months.
Yeah.
And then
mm-hmm.
April General Conference, a woman prays.
Mm-hmm.
No fanfare.
Right.
No announcements.
Of course not. Wait, yeah.
Seriously, like no press press notice or any
right.
notification, no acknowledgement of the fact that now after decades and decades and decades within the church, for the first time a woman is actually going to pray at a general conference. They just said, Jean Stephens is going to give the closing prayer or whatever.
Yeah, and she did.
Say something about that. The fact that they change,
mm-hmm.
but they don't say anything about it.
Well, that was, I mean, and Amber, I think you were saying was that, you know, there was that initial press release before general conference. So they acknowledged the movement.
Mm-hmm.
But once the change happened, they also did the double acknowledgement saying, well, the movement isn't what made this happen. Right.
Exactly.
It was like, don't confuse your movement with making this change.
Mm-hmm.
The timing was just so crazy. You had to see them in connection.
Right. It was 183 years that a woman had gone without praying in general conference.
Wow.
So the first time, at least on record, and we had plenty of people scouring records of general conference, and there was no woman on record. And so, yeah, to have this big change. And then like the news stations picked it up. And so they put out these, you know, press stories saying like, look, this big thing happened. And the church's press response was, well, we had had this plan for months, long in advance before.
This was our idea. Our idea. It wasn't your idea.
Yeah.
Is that what they were saying, basically?
I mean, that was the insinuation. Totally.
Yeah.
The thing.
By the way, do you think that's true?
That they had planned it months and months.
Yeah.
If it is, it's a really big coincidence.
A big coincidence.
Yeah.
I mean,
a big coincidence.
So I guess the question is, like we're going, like at the top of the show we were talking about, is what's the risk you run if you acknowledge that these women have something to do with it?
Yeah.
And apparently they saw it as a risk. Because even if they had planned it months in advance, if it was truly just an oversight, there would at least be some element of gratitude for people bringing it to their attention. wasn't that. There wasn't the acknowledgement that this brought to their attention. And so that seems to me like that is an internal decision to not encourage that kind of activism again. Mm-hmm.
But how did that make you feel? That there was not that you were looking for credit, but right. some sort of acknowledgement that the thing that you had been talking about, the letter writing campaign that you had initiated, the things that you had been saying in small wards throughout the country, I'm guessing, throughout the church, and no acknowledgement whatsoever. How did that make you feel?
It was awful. I mean, I think a big part of me felt like I was getting this message that if I was going to continue to ask questions, that wasn't going to be allowed by the highest, most part of the church. And that made me question whether there was a place for me in the church to keep asking questions and being myself. Of course, there was a part of me that was happy just that the change had happened at all.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I was really thinking like, cool, like I can continue to have this impact in my church and have this say and bring up things to leaders' attention that they might not be thinking about. And I think the message that I got was, no, you can't, and it's a risk for us to even, make acknowledgement that you were involved in this. And then, of course, what we saw afterwards was kind of the public response going alongside with what the church had said, saying that it was a big coincidence, or the nicer response was that the Holy Ghost had prompted us at the same time that it had prompted the church leadership to make the change. As much as I did feel, guided by the Spirit to do activism, I didn't quite see it as being that level of coincidence, and was more hurt, I think, that I was being told that I couldn't continue to have this kind of communication with church around what changes could or couldn't be made.
Worth pointing out, you weren't disciplined, though.
Right,
and
yeah.
None of the women involved in the group were disciplined, right?
Right.
So
yeah.
in that way, that is a little different from the examples we were using earlier.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that they weren't validated, but they weren't truly chastened, right? So that was kind of they were walking a line there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, if you can call it this, I think we did a good job of doing activism that was just acceptable enough. And maybe that's where the change happens, is when you can do that kind of activism that is just acceptable enough that it's not, super radical. But I can't help but acknowledge that seeing now that this kind of isn't like a big deal anymore, that movements like Ordain Women help to make it so that there are more tame ways of doing activism that make it the public opinion changes so that it becomes more acceptable to do things like let women pray.
That's Amber Chorby Whiteley. She's a co-founder of Let Women Pray. We also have with us Lee Hale. He's working on a new religion podcast for KUER. His story on faith and activism is available at KUER.org. You can also hear the story this afternoon during All Things Considered. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for KUER comes from the local and national businesses around the state that underwrite our programming. Shows like Morning Edition, Radio West, and All Things Considered. If your business or organization cares about the in-depth local news and fascinating conversations you can only find on public radio, team up with KUER. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, look for the Support tab at KUER.org and click on Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the best way to get your church to change something. We're talking about the LDS Church in this case. And the question the reporter Lee Hale has been asking in a story he's produced, basically it's this question: who gets credit for change when it comes? Is it the faithful who are driving it quietly from inside, or the activists making a ruckus in public? Lee Hale is joining us in the studio, along with Amber Chorby Whiteley. She's co-founder of the group Let Women Pray. Joining us now on the program is Matthew Bowman. He is an associate professor of history at Henderson State University in Arkansas. He specializes in the history of American religions. He's the author of the book, The Mormon People, The Making of an American Faith. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug.
So I guess I wanted to start with the first question that came up as a result of our conversation with Lee and Amber, and that is, what is it that's keeping LDS church leaders from just saying at conference, hey, we heard from a lot of women, and they're asking, can we have a woman pray at General Conference? And that seems like a good idea. Here we go. Like, what's keeping that from happening, do you think?
Oh, a lot of things. It's my inclination, I think, as a historian, to say it's complicated, because it's always complicated, right? And there's a number of different factors here. And I think the two maybe that I'll speak to, the two most relevant that I will speak to, are first, that there has been, I think, over the past 100 or so years of history, a real fear of controversy in the church. We could look at earlier examples, right? In the 19th century, there was a lot of infighting among church leadership and even between church leaders and church members over controversial things. I think the best example might be the Adam God Doctrine, which Brigham Young taught, which other church leaders disagreed with him vocally about, which some church members raised issues about, and which eventually was abandoned. In the early 20th century, there was a similar controversy over the theory of evolution in the church. And the result, particularly of that dispute over evolution, was this. After several general authorities spoke out against each other, saying, this person is wrong. No, this person is wrong. I'm right about evolution. No, I'm right. The presidency of the church issued a broad declaration to all of them saying, stop fighting about this in public. And since then, we've seen, I think, a real emphasis upon unity, upon really among...
Or perceived unity, anyway.
Perceived unity, absolutely, among church leadership, that when we speak, it will be as one. When the church speaks, it will be united. We're not going to have public disputes. And I think certainly that has been influential in how the church has approached these topics since. Another, and I think a related factor, is the transformation of the church over the 20th century.
Yeah.
When the church entered the 20th century, there were far fewer than a million members. Today, there are 16 million. When, for instance, a woman named Aurelia Rogers wanted to found the primary of the church, when she had this idea to do it, she simply went to Eliza R. Snow, who was president of the Relief Society. She went to John Taylor, the president of the church, and said, here's my idea.
But it's like knock on the door and say, hey, can we talk about this idea?
Precisely. Yeah. And Joseph F.
Which
Smith.
Which seems so quaint now, of
exactly.
course.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, Joseph F. Smith, who was president of the church in the early 20th century, would regularly meet with people who would just walk into church headquarters and want to talk with him. That is difficult now, in part, I think, because of this sort of fear of controversy, but also because simply the church is too large.
That's practically impossible.
Exactly. And so what has happened is the church has shifted in a sociological sense from a church kind of led by informal networks, a church run by simply people who know each other, who meet at parties or in each other's homes, to a very institutionalized, bureaucratized organization. Right. And that then, you know, bureaucracies have their own momentum. They have their own inertia. And whether that be out of intention or not, it simply makes informal change or change happening along informal lines very, very difficult. Now, certainly, I think there are some in church leadership who are happy with that. But there are others, I think, who are simply ignorant about it. And I think the question of women praying General Conference is one. I think simply nobody thought about it. And they simply, the ball went as it had always gone, right? Because there were no outlets for voices, particularly female voices, to raise that
So
question.
If you have this kind of corporate is that a proper word?
In many ways,
kind
yes,
of an institutional or corporate structure now because of practical reasons and all seemingly well-intentioned reasons. What does that mean for moments when someone like Amber or other women are like, this is not right. We need to figure this out. I mean, so it's almost like there's not a mechanism now for something like that in a system like this.
Yes, unless it comes from the top, right? Or unless people at the top consciously attempt to make that happen. And say, you know, we need to find ways to bring this in. When this was happening, and certainly the major period, or the major, I think, what we might call the force that forces the church to bureaucratize in this way is called correlation, which is a process that begins really soon after World War I and reaches its peak in the 1960s and 70s. And at that point, as the church is being reorganized and bureaucratized, church leaders do, in some cases, make attempts. They hire outside consulting firms to tell them, how can we best kind of organize this? They thought, we need to listen to people on the outside to tell us how to do this very, very well. But once that is locked in, you know, once these patterns of authority and hierarchy are put into place, then the door is closed in a lot of ways.
Wow.
And Doug, I was thinking, I mean, well, Matt, you make this point about how most people's experience with the church is their local congregation. That's the majority of their experience. Mm-hmm. And it's worth stating that with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, there still is a lot of local autonomy, actually. I mean, leaders can get pretty creative with a lot of the things they do locally. Sometimes they might get their hand slapped and say, well, don't do that, right? You can't do that. There's some things you can't change. You can't change manuals. You can't change some callings. Yeah. But you can do it. You can start a new program for the youth, or try this new thing that you might think might be effective. But because, I mean, just because of the way the world is right now, internet and social media, if you, I think, are a member of the church, what the church is doing globally affects you, I think, kind of in a new way. Mm. Like right now, it's like you, I think with a lot of millennial Mormons especially, they feel responsible for the global church. And that then it gets complicated. Then you have a lot of opinions about how it's run worldwide, and then you feel powerless. Then that feels like there's no call for innovation. I think that the church has a system where they will invite people to headquarters on invitation kind of only. They'll get together some groups, and they'll bring some members in and kind of do these roundtable meetings and talk about potential changes. I know before the Mormon and Gay website was rolled out, they brought in some people from the community and said, what do you think about this? And they offered some tweaks. And I think there was some listening there. But that was invitation, right? So if you're presenting an idea, I think that there's no clear venue.
So I wonder if you think, and maybe this is an unfair question, but is there a kind of lack of humility among church leaders because maybe they're isolated, maybe because of this sort of general impression that, look, change comes from the tippy top, guys? And it seems like in some ways it's petty. It seems a little like petulance in some ways, this unwillingness to be able to acknowledge, oh, somebody else had a good idea. Somebody else brought this sort of thing to us. Is that an unfair way to challenge their motives, I guess?
I have two thoughts about that. The first is another impact of the growth of the church and of really the church's place in the modern world. As the church got bigger, as the church began to produce centralized manuals and media, and as the church entered the modern media age, the leaders of the church became celebrities, which is a very modern concept, right? Yeah. And a modern thing. And I think in some ways this was intentional, right? In some ways, their authority and their mystique was encouraged by the institution. In other ways, it was inadvertent because, you know, we're all kind of figuring out what it means to be a human in this modern world we live in. But that then attaches to them a sort of mystique in the ways it does with anybody, right? And that has an effect on how you live. You do sort of exist in a bubble.
Yeah. So you start believing your own press.
Yeah, sometimes, right? Another, though, I thought about this is one from a theologian named Reinhold Niebuhr, who wrote a book called Moral Man and Immoral Society. And the central argument of this book was institutions in a lot of ways have lives of their own. And institutions behave in ways differently than individuals do. Institutions really function in ways that can be more damaging than any individual would choose to do on their own, right? Because there is, in some ways, a diffusion of responsibility within institutions.
So you begin with an ecstatic vision and the sense of inclusion, and we're all in this together. But in order for it to succeed as a church, you've got to start sort of backing off on that. You've got to start institutionalizing.
Right.
And
that happens with nearly everything. I mean, this is sort of sociology of religion 101.
Right.
Is you start with a charismatic leader and you end up with a bureaucracy. That's how it happens with any religion.
Yeah.
Right. And as that bureaucracy evolves and takes on this life of its own, it will develop an inertia.
What do you think about this, Amber? I wanted to get your sense of it, like this idea that maybe the leaders are lacking a bit of humility without because they're not just acknowledging something that would be quite easy is to say, hey, Amber, that was a pretty good idea.
Right.
Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, kind of piggybacking off of what you're talking about, Matt, with this idea that leaders are celebrities, the thing that comes to mind for me as a convert, and I think I constantly am thinking that things that are really normal within the church and normal for people who grow up within the church, and I can appreciate the church culture that has been created over hundreds of years of institutionalizing, seems really weird as an outsider, and seems really weird to me as a convert that there couldn't be this piece of humility that that leaders do kind of become insulated. And for me, even as a professional in psychology, like I'm constantly being thought and told to think through my own biases and how they might be impacting other people. And so I would love to be a part of a church that also does some of that top-down thinking through what some biases might be that are entering in and changing policies and then being willing to humbly, like I think that I feel more connected to people when they can, in a humble way, be able to say, wow, that was an oversight, and thanks for bringing this up. That makes me feel more connected. And I can appreciate that. And the way I kind of conceptualized the change at the time is that the sense I got was that it was scary to admit that members could have any kind of impact on the church, and how my thought about what they were thinking is that it would be scary to admit that we had influenced them, and what would that open up then for the future of members?
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? That the implications of letting the inmates run the
I guess,
the
yeah. I mean, for me, I'm like, would that be so bad? I don't think so. But I can imagine that when you're in the position of making all the decisions for the church, and that you don't want controversy, that you want everything to appear like everything's peaceful, and that there's so much around that I don't totally understand this too. But we have quite a bit of an issue within the church of like, how is change brought down? Is it from God? Mm-hmm. Is it from the Holy Spirit? Is it from the prophet? And we kind of have been following this narrative that every single change is being made by God and the Holy Spirit. Can't we just admit that some things are just policies that just, you know, some guy with his own biases made the policy, you know, or that there are oversights like forgetting to invite women to pray in general conference? You know?
Well, Matthew Bowman, why? Why can't they? Are they institutionally, doctrinally constrained from making that kind of admission?
This is a deep, deep tension, I think, within Mormonism. And you brought this up earlier, Amber, when you spoke about feeling inspired yourself to do this, right? And you looking to Joseph Smith for that, right? On the one hand, right, there is this sense of Mormonism as a restoration, as the restoration of a church and priestly organization. On the other, there is this example of Joseph Smith breaking off and doing his own thing. And both of those impulses are present in the church, right? And the way Mormons use the term revelation, I think, is something that's changed over time, absolutely. And thinking of revelation, to kind of, I think, qualify a dichotomy that's been set up before a little bit, that it's either revelation or it's people agitating for reform, thinking of those as two different things, I think, is an interesting product of the historical age that the church is in right now. Mm-hmm. That revelation is something that comes to church leaders, not to the church as a body. Mm-hmm. The Community of Christ, which used to be the RLDS Church, right, speaks of the church as a prophetic people. And I think there are models in other Christian churches for thinking of revelation that happens to a community, not just to one person.
Wait, so on that point, the Community of Christ, you're talking about what used to be called the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So are you saying that they may have been taking some of the dynamics of the early LDS church and that maybe was more inclusive of the body of the church, and so it's using maybe an older form that that now conventional Mormonism is not using?
I don't know that I would say that necessarily. Because, in fact, I think in a lot of ways, Joseph Smith was less tolerant of dissent than the modern church is.
We should point that out. He excommunicated a lot of people who didn't agree
with him. Certainly, yeah. I think there is something that I've called before the Mormon declension narrative, which is to say the early church was fun and interesting, and the modern church is boring and and gray. And that's not quite the case.
Yeah.
But it is, I think, there are examples, I think, in church history of what I'm talking about, which is to say the body of the church sort of saying, and I think, the Adam God doctrine is an interesting example of this. This is something Brigham Young taught, something other church leaders embraced, but which many other people said, that's weird and I don't like it. And after Brigham Young dies, it sort of fades. Mm-hmm. Right. And you know, if a theologian were to approach that, they might say, well, this was an example of the Spirit moving the body of the church in the right direction when the leader of the church was not in the right direction. And so that kind of model, I think, allows us to maybe think about this dichotomy in some interesting ways and to complicate it a little bit.
The closest example to the idea of kind of being, you know, having open office hours, you talk about the church of old and kind of taking ideas from the members. Occasionally, a thing will happen. Happen in the churches that general authorities, top leaders, will go and have kind of Q&A mm-hmm. with members. Mm-hmm. And the best example I can think of this happening on a large scale is Russell Ballard, one of the apostles, went to BYU relatively recently, maybe it was a year or two ago now, and he was answering questions that were submitted. And one of the questions was about LGBT members. And kind of this more informal, off-the-cuff responding to you, he said some things about inclusion and loving LGBT members that, quite frankly, people have gotten a lot of mileage out of. Like, it's probably the most inclusive thing a general authority has ever said about LGBT members happened in that kind of Q&A scenario. So there is precedent for something like this, like the idea of we're listening to you, usually in just settings like that. But that seemed to be a really, like, from my view, and maybe some church leaders hated what he said, but from my view, as somebody who covers LGBT issues,
it was refreshing.
He did a world of good. I still see his quotes on Twitter circulating because nothing has been said like it since. And so if that's any indication of what could happen, I think that they should be encouraged. I don't quite get what they're worried about.
If I might say, I think another stereotype that we might do well to break here is to, you know, this is the stereotype of Mormons as people who are just walking in lockstep and following leaders and doing only what they're told and nothing else. There are many, many examples in the 20th century of the church changing because of things that members did.
Amber's a good example.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. Well, but also I think dedications of graves and dedications of homes. These are two things that are now in the church manual as official ordinances that started simply because people began doing them. Mm. And they seeped upward and now are official. Missionary farewells, which is a practice that was recently discontinued, was something that's happened on the grassroots, right? So there is actually, I think, in terms of practice, in terms of the ways that Mormons do things and that Mormons live day to day, it's very much a give and take, I think, between the laity and the leadership.
We're running out of time, and I want to get to this last point. All right, because I want to get you all on this. What works better, do you think? If you are a Latter-day Saint and you want a particular change to be made, is it better to try and work within the channels, or is it better to try and kick up some dust? Or if not that, do what Amber did. You know, go to social media, go public with it. Like, which is the thing that's going to actually get change to happen? And maybe the answer, Lee, is both. I don't know. How would you respond to that?
I think one thing I see happening right now with some activists, it's kind of interesting because they're taking kind of a different route, which is we're not going to expect the church to change, but we're going to make our feelings known regardless. And so you have some, for instance, some LGBT Mormon groups, and I don't know if they're actively petitioning the church all the time for change, but they're saying we are Mormons and we are allies and we're here. And that seems pretty powerful. Mm-hmm. Like, that creates cultural change. And so I guess when it comes to church change, I would say I have no idea. Quite frankly, I have no idea what's going to happen. And change is happening with kind of at a rapid rate in some ways right now. So I've given up giving predictions. But when it comes to cultural change, especially in the age of social media, for you saying I am a Latter-day Saint and I also believe this, I also, you know, welcome these people into my life, whoever that might be, right? Or I'm a feminist or whatever it is. That seems like that is creates cultural change, and it seems significant.
What do you think?
I think it depends on if you have access even to the channels in the first place. So thinking about, you know, if you have access, if you work within the church office buildings and you're able to, like, catch someone in the elevator and propose an idea, I don't know.
But forget that. Take that aside. That's impossible.
If you
are you.
Right.
And you want to affect change.
Right. That's what I'm saying is that there's really only one way to be able to do it. There's not the access, especially for, I think, a lot of women. We know that it's a really hard place to be able to continue to be active if you're an LGBTQ Mormon. And so I think that we're starting to see more marginalized folks not having even the channel to be able to make this change, except for what Lee's kind of speaking to, this, like, cultural change and continuing to show up within the local ward buildings and making so that each individual ward can change and hope that that's creating more of a global church change. And maybe to point out what you're talking about, Matt, is, like, church members are leading their lives, that then there will be this grassroots effect up to the top of the church policy. I don't know, and I'm with you. I think this is so complicated, and I think that in terms of what makes change, there's just so many things at play. And a big part of that is, what do you have access to and who can you kind of speak to with the change that you want to make?
Looking, I think, at the big picture of American society and really Western society, there seem to be two big paradigms for these sorts of people: the reformer and the revolutionary, right? Mm-hmm. The one who works within a system, the one who burns the system down. And what often happens, and I think the great paradigm for this is the Black Freedom Movement of the 50s and 60s, right, is that revolutionaries tend to push the Overton window open. Revolutionaries tend to say, I'm going to reach for the furthest possible possibility, and in so doing, make more marginal possibilities possible. And that's where reformers come in, right? The people who are within structures. And so often these two, I think, act in concert with each other, right? They work together, even if they don't like each other or if they see each other not necessarily as allies. In the broad spectrum, I think these two groups do tend to complement each other. And I think we've seen that in the context of Mormon feminism, certainly over the past 10 years or so, that process happening.
It seems like you have to play the long game.
Often, yeah. And I think, you know, as a historian, I'm a fan of the long game.
You're a fan of the long game because you studied the long game. But if you're Amber, the long game's depressing, right?
Yeah. I was just going to say, I hate the long game.
Yeah, but I don't blame you, right?
So, okay, so finally, do you think, I won't ask for predictions, but can you go back to that sort of progressive era, Matthew Bowman, that you write about, where people were making these grassroots changes, were engaged in innovation, engaged in the process of building? Can you ever really go back there and address these issues, or are we or is the church so kind of settled into its institutional, you know, condition that it even if it wanted to, it couldn't?
Yeah, I think the second, in part because, you know, this era of, you know, the Utah period of church history between, you know, the arrival of the saints in Utah and the 1920s or so was a period of institution building. There were simply not institutions there, and so there was a lot of energy and a lot of space for that. We're not there anymore. But at the same time, we're not there because the world around the church has changed. Mormons now are not just members of the church. Mormons now are in graduate school. They're working corporations. They live as part of the modern world. Mm-hmm. And so the world that those people lived in was the church. Everything was the church, right? So there was a lot of that kind of space, and those two things aren't true anymore.
You finally, are you hopeful then? I mean, hearing that sounds like not pessimism, but reality. How are you thinking about this finally?
I mean, the thing that I come back to is thinking about my clients who are really impacted by the church, who when I do therapy with people who, you know, with gay clients or with clients who are impacted by racism within the church, who really want there to be changes now so that they're not facing the kind of distress that they're currently in. I appreciate like looking at this, you know, the long game, the historical, you know, systemic approach to this. But then I think to myself that there's this very real in the moment personal impact on people when changes aren't happening. And when certain changes, like the policy change that happened within the church regarding not letting children of gay members being able to be baptized, that impacts real people in their real lives, and whether they feel like they can remain within the church or whether their suicidal thoughts increase. And I think for me as a convert as well, there's a piece of me that's like, well, what the heck? Why can't we get this together and just start making changes quicker? And so I can appreciate that that's not how systemically, structurally we are set up. And it has a real impact on people's lives that I don't think should be ignored.
That's Amber Chorby-Whiteley. She's co-founder of the group Let Women Pray, joined us here in the studio. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew Bowman, author of The Mormon People, The Making of an American Faith. He teaches history at Henderson State University in Arkansas. Glad you were in town. Thanks for joining us.
Glad I was too. Thank you.
And Lee Hale, he's, of course, with KUER, working on a new religion podcast for KUER. We can't say much more than that, but
Top secret stuff.
I'll mention that History on Faith and Activism is available at KUER.org, and you can hear this afternoon that story on All Things Considered. Lee, thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the show directed by Michael Havey, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.